This audio is a recording from the Rethinking Revolution discussion series held in Chaumes-Brie. This recording was made in April 2010 at the second of these sessions, and it's on revolution in our lifetime. It asks the question, are we spending our precious time outside of work at protests and meetings because we want to improve our lives, or are we just fighting for future generations? In either case, what is it that we are trying to do as we move from topic to topic and struggle to struggle? Alan Maximone doesn't expect to see the glorious day while Andrew Flood is preparing it for being just around the corner. A note on the recording device failed midway through the introductions, so I had to re-record my talk and use the second device to record some of the discussion. Unfortunately, I missed about the first 5 or 10 minutes of the discussion. Apologies to anyone whose contributions were lost because of that. You'll find more audios like this on the WSM website at www.wsm.ie.
First, I'd just like to welcome everyone to the second Rethinking Revolution. It's going to be a series of meetings organised by the Workers' Solidarity Movement, just about various different aspects of politics. So obviously, tonight we're talking about revolution, and obviously revolution is integral to anarchist politics. It has been quite a while since there's been one. So tonight we've got a debate between Alan and Andrew, asking the question, will we see a revolution in our lifetimes? So Alan is going to start arguing that we probably won't, and Andrew then is going to take up and say that maybe not as far away as you think. So over to Alan.
Okay, well, I suppose, like, when do you expect to see a revolution in life? Well, it probably depends on your age. Anyway, first of all, I reckon we have to be clear in our minds what we mean by revolution. A lot of people have a stereotyped picture of what a revolution is like. To them, it's when people come with guns, surround an army base, or take over a city. This is confusing revolution with insurrection. Now, insurrection is just one stage of a revolution. Revolution itself is a lot more. It's a long process. It means a complete change in the way society is run, and that means building up understanding and support for the ideas you want to replace capitalism with. The late Peter Camejo, an American leftist who died a few years ago, put it like this. In a certain way, you could make a parallel between revolution and pregnancy. In the very early stages of pregnancy, if you're just looking at a woman, you can't tell whether she's pregnant. If you're asked, you'll probably say no. However, with the use of science, like scans and so on, you can determine that very early on that the woman is actually pregnant, but it's only later that it becomes evident for everyone to see. And revolution's probably a little bit like that. We generally only see revolution, as you understand it, when we reach the stage of dual power. That's when the ruling class can no longer fully enforce its rule, and the working class is refusing to be governed in the old way. Neither side has complete control, and one or the other will have to come out on top. But is this still the case in the 21st century? Well, I think it is. Because there's a contradiction at the heart of capitalism. A contradiction between the fantastic potential for solving human needs in this society and the existing reality. Everything you see, everything you wear or eat, your car, your house, you didn't make any of these things yourself personally. We don't produce most things as individuals. We produce socially. We have a division of work throughout the whole world. People in one country make things which people in another use. But even though we produce socially, that is through cooperation, we don't own the means of production socially. And this affects all the basic decisions made in this society about what we produce. These decisions are not made on the basis of what people need, but on the basis of what makes a profit. Take the question of hunger. People go hungry all over the world, and yet, because of the profit system, governments pay farmers not to grow stuff, the scheme known as set-aside. Farmers don't make their decisions by saying stuff like, people need a lot of wheat, so I'm going to plant a lot of wheat. Never say that. They'll say, how much money am I going to make if I plant wheat this year? I'd take the question of housing. If you took all the money that's been spent on bailing out the gamblers of Anglo-Irish, AIB and Bank of Ireland, you could tear up everybody's mortgage and give everybody a free home. Yet that's not going to happen, because it's not profitable. In addition, you have a mammoth, organised effort to create waste. For instance, if somebody here went off and designed a car for, say, Ford Motor Company, A car that would last for 50 years. They wouldn't use it, it wouldn't go into production, because that would destroy the purpose of making cars, which is to produce profits. After all, like, you know, if one car's going to last 50 years, what do you do if you're expecting to sell someone a new car every 5 or 10 years? So how does the ruling class hold on to its power, keep this system going? In Ireland, we've got a few thousand people running a society of over 5 million. And most people don't even see it like that. In the past, ruling classes were proud of their role. They walk around like literally with gold crowns on their head or fancy ceremonial robes. And, you know, if they went down the street, everyone could say, hey, look, there goes one of the ruling class. Nowadays, they're smarter. They don't do that. Now they go around saying there aren't any classes anymore in Ireland, that everybody's middle class, only that some are a little bit more middle class than others. When was the last time you heard someone say capitalism's a great system? Or when did you ever hear someone say, Jesus, just think of what our ruling class has done for us. Jesus, they really deserve our full support. Today, the small size of the ruling class means that other classes have a lot more power in comparison. We have a working class that has a great deal of potential power. Like, if you think what a general strike would be like in Dublin, workers could take over the city in a matter of hours. Because workers run everything, the buses, the Lewis, the Dart, the trucks that bring food to Tesco, supply of gas, light, heat, everything. So you have to ask yourself, why is this power not used? Why not just kick out the tiny parasitical minority? And I reckon the reason's fairly simple. Most people have illusions. They believe that the system we live under is the only one possible, that's basically fair, and we just need to remove corrupt individuals like Bertie Ahern or Michael Fingleton or Seanan Fitzpatrick. I reckon that the whole strategy of making a revolution in Ireland is dependent on understanding this. The minority can rule only through maintaining illusions that the system is basically fair and that there's no alternative anyway. If tomorrow Brian Cowan went on the RT News and said, OK, I'm going to let you all in on it. There's a few thousand of us running this country and we've decided to cancel all elections. We're abolishing freedom of speech, freedom of assembly and so on. So get back to work or get back to your universities. And if there's any disturbance or disobedience, we'll throw you all into jail. How long would the ruling class stay in power after something like that? They couldn't do it. Their power is already limited by a certain consciousness, a certain limited sense of entitlement that exists in most people. A ruler's power is limited by the fact that most people believe in free speech and free assembly and in some form of democracy. Of course, we can't be naive about the ruling class. They will suppress opposition insofar as they can get away with it. And they will use the most brutal means available if they feel they have to, like the Chilean coup in the mid-70s. But they will try to keep repression within the bounds of what they think they can get away with. They don't want to wake up the majority of people. They don't want to destroy the illusion of fairness. Because if most of us begin to wake up and think about it, that presents a really big danger to the status quo. As I see it, the key to victory for us is all about motivating the majority of people. Any concept, any struggle that ignores this will only end in disaster. There is no shortcut to changing the system. It takes a long time. And I think we have to have a perspective of fighting for 10, 20, 30 or more years. This isn't to say that revolutionary possibilities don't occur. They do happen all the time. Some of the best known, Russia 1917, Spain 1936, Hungary in 56, Portugal in 74, Iran in 79, or indeed over the last year or two, Nepal, where you could say an anti-feudal revolution had been completed. They basically killed, or at least started the job of killing off feudalism. Doesn't mean they're getting anywhere near socialism. They're doing there, I suppose, what the French Revolution did over two centuries ago. But none of these revolutionary opportunities ended up creating the sort of society we want to see. And probably not surprisingly, if anarchist ideas are not the most popular ideas around, then it stands to reason that other ideas will dominate. That's why what we call the battle of ideas is the most important battle. That's why we not only explain and promote anarchism and combat the ideas of capitalism, but also combat what we see as the false alternatives, whether it be Leninism in Ireland or indeed Islamicism in Iran. You can't walk into WSM and say, though Andrew may disagree. I want to guarantee the revolution will happen in 5 years, because after that I've got other plans. Revolution doesn't work that way. So, just to finish up, I want to say this. The ruling class is never going to solve our problems. Capitalism can't do it. Therefore, the objective conditions for revolution are going to rise up again and again and again. We don't create those conditions. But there is one thing we can do. We can create the subjective factor, the ideas around which society can be reorganised. It's not enough to fight against capitalism. You also have to know what you want to replace it with. And you need to make that alternative the most popular one around. And that, I would see as being the most important task for revolutionaries today. And Sinné.
Over to Andrew to promote the case for the revolution soon.
For the far left today, across most of the Western world, revolution has become something akin to the return of Christ for your average Christian. That is, the idea that a revolution is needed and will happen is a required article of faith. Everybody's meant to believe in this. But almost no revolutionary acts in a manner that suggests it's at all likely in the near future, as far as they're concerned. I started to give this question a good bit of thought quite a while back when we were preparing a day school on modern revolutions, and looking specifically at the upheavals in Paris in 1968 and Portugal in 1974, as well as a couple of others. But when you look at those upheavals of the 60s and 70s, and indeed the events in this country in the same period, you see that revolutionary situations in the modern period unfold fast, very fast, and that the ideas taken up during them are those of the groups that already have some sort of large-scale membership and profile. You quite often have the thing where it's small groups, in fact, with much better ideas and a much better understanding of what's going on, but for considerable periods of time they're trapped in a position where they can only really denounce whatever is happening in terms of strategy and direction. If you look at Paris 68, for instance, it might well be that today's situation is posters decorate the walls of 1,000 student flats across Dublin, but it was the French Communist Party that controlled the direction of the mass movement and which drove it into the ground. In Portugal, the Social Democrats played the same sort of role, despite the fact that in Portugal there were probably 100 competing revolutionary groups with a different set of ideas. Now, up to that point in time, I'd held a fairly standard comfort blanket of the small revolutionary group, and that is that it didn't matter that there were only five of us meeting week after week in the back room of the Halfpenny Inn, because come the ripening of conditions, our ideas would be so well polished that all we would have to do was expose them to the masses, and our ideas would be swept up. Okay, a little bit more sophisticated than that, but you get the general idea. That's generally how small revolutionary groups look at things. This critique of formal political organisation, though, also applies to kind of radical academic study circles and social centres. It's a critique, really, of all organisation that does not have a plan for growth beyond its own small circle of adherents. In Ireland, within these last 2 years, we've seen the hopes of hundreds of thousands of people smashed through layoffs, repeated pay cuts, and in many cases, a massive millstone of negative equity debt being put around people's necks that they're going to be paying off for three or more decades. Alongside this, the links between the political parties and the capitalist class have been exposed through the tribunal process. Pretty much everyone understands that the billions being handed over to the banks are being handed over to the inhabitants of the Fianna Fáil tent of the Galway races. The Catholic Church, which for decades provided the social cement holding southern society under the thumb of authoritarian control, has crumbled to dust in the escalating wave of child abuse scandals. On the theoretical level, it's hard to imagine a more fertile moment for being a revolutionary. You go to Mars and you hear all this for a moment, you're thinking this must be an incredible period of change here, people must be in the streets. But of course, all of us here have lived through this period, and we're only too aware of how we've completely failed to build the movements out of this opportunity that could have made use of its revolutionary potential. And if, as some would argue, the crisis we've been going through was not such an opportunity for revolution, what do we imagine such an opportunity would actually look like in a Western country? We neither built a movement when people's expectations were expanding during the Celtic Tiger, nor when those dreams were crushed during the crisis. If it was not possible in either period due to objective conditions, then in Ireland and the West in general, it appears no time was or will be the right time. A revolution is like the Second Coming, an article of faith. We don't have any actual belief in it. It's not hard to see how there was no spontaneous development of a revolutionary movement in this crisis. Capitalist ideology has a massive hold on popular consciousness in this country, to the point that it's largely invisible and unquestionable. It's simply seen as common sense. You get that if you listen to talk radio all the time. The mass-produced daily newspaper, the radio and the TV are all hammering home the message that there was no alternative, and that those who did try and fight were just fighting for themselves and against you.
the theoretical one no many yeses that our movement used to use became so many not me's in this context. A very visible demoralisation has happened that is reflected in a lot of our activity. I remember back in the 80s some friends prayed fuck emigration, stay and fight on the big wall down at Dunleary that the Dart passes as it reached the Dunleary ferry. Emigration has restarted, and more generally people have started to walk away from organising, turning previous movements activity into the basis for a career, taking refuge in the hedonistic escapes of drugs and constant partying that provides the heart of a heartless world for many in this post-religion age. Are doing what the majority of people have always done in such circumstances of retreat, narrow their focus on making it as best a life they can for themselves and their families. Could things have been different? More importantly, how could they have been different? The answer to this is both simple and seemingly impossible. What we needed as the crisis unfolded was a scale of organisation that saw activists in every neighbourhood and workplace offer a collective and coherent alternative to what was to come and starting the process of organising resistance.
Our movement failed to build, or even take seriously the need to build, the sort of movement we needed to turn the capitalist crisis into the revolution in our lifetime. Indeed, in an overcorrection to the faults of the Leninist movement that preceded us, we often opposed the processes that would have been required to prepare for that moment. By this I mean the construction of an agreed set of goals and methodologies to give us the numbers, resources and collective strategy we needed to build the organisations by the start of the crisis in 2007-2008, which could have given a different direction to what has unfolded since. The one place I did see this happen is in some of the union branches, where there was enough activists and enough preparation as the crisis broke for a process of unfortunately very localised radicalisation to take place. Where I work, we had over a dozen assemblies open to all members in the period of the crisis, and the fact that people could take part in a process of collective discussion and decision-making very visibly radicalised those who participated in it. In our debate this week on the public sector agreements, apart from the branch official who argued for it, no one in the room thought it was worth voting for. This would not be a pattern elsewhere in the same union, and it also would not have been the pattern a couple of years ago before this process of collective discussion started. But at the start of the crisis, the left was so weak that something like this really only happened in a handful of the hundreds of branches in the country. Nothing like enough to put an actual programme of struggle forward to every union member in the country as a realistic alternative to the sellout strategy of the union leadership. And nothing like the number of people with the needed pre-existing relationships of trust and common purpose to see the coordination of a struggle in every branch to take the fight out of the hands of that same leadership. Often, the idea that we need to wait for objective conditions to ripen leaves both individuals and organisations unprepared and even reluctant to recognise the moments when they emerge. We slip into steady routines of activity that are hard to break out of. And it is at these moments that hard work and the correct slogans could actually make a difference, if we are talking the Irish context of thousands of people pushing in a coordinated way. It's important to stress here, I am not talking of organisations of tens and hundreds of thousands of people, but rather the sort of organisation that could have one person in every workplace, one person in every neighbourhood. I argue that there can be a revolution in my lifetime because I think turning points where the potential of revolution exists are not all that infrequent. They don't have to involve just one major factor, as with the current crisis. They can also be a point at which several minor turning points collide or happen in quick succession, allowing organisation built for one to become the organisation building, this time from the stronger base for the next. On a very trivial level, we saw that in Dublin in relation to the Reclaim the Streets protests that built towards the anti-war movement and the direct action end of that, and which in turn built towards May Day 2005. The direction of these turning points take towards collective action or individual survival and not meism in the current crisis depends on the ability of various organisations in society to exert influence. With this crisis, IBEC, Fianna Fáil, the O'Reilly family, who own much of Ireland's media, Joe Duffy, and to a more limited extent the trade union leadership, were the ones with the tools that enabled them to exert a mass influence. The likes of the WSM or any other force on the left had neither the numbers or the resources to have much of an impact. My use of the phrase hard work and the correct slogans above is intended to jar, to provoke a response. It's meant to carry the suggestion of the orthodox communists and the methodology our movement has rejected. Because frankly, our rejection has lacked nuance and we've tended to throw the baby out with the bathwater. The common expectation today, for instance, is that political activity has to be fun in order for it to be worthwhile. But the reality is often one of hard slog and holding things together, particularly in those tense moments when things are going badly and perhaps even backbiting begins. This will never be fun, but it is essential. Another problem is that our movement seldom bothers to talk out rather than talk about political differences. We almost never resolve these in order to reach a collective agreement. This means our ideas frequently fail to develop. We just keep going around through the same old cycle of disagreement. And more importantly, you can't have a collective implementation of something unless you first of all agree collectively what you intend to implement. One of the attractions of Orthodox Marxism in building mass organisation was its claim to be able to scientifically predict revolution, and normally to do so in the near future. Today we understand that the movements of society are not predictable in such a crude manner, but in understanding that, we need to understand that this very unpredictability is what results in turning points appearing and colliding without warning, and which makes the ability to rapidly and collectively escalate the pace of activity essential. We're not looking at situations where there are years of warning, where there are slow lead-ins. We are looking at periods of almost instantaneous transformation. The movement of the 1960s ended with a turn to authoritarian politics, because that appeared to promise a level of discipline that seemed to be the cure for the problems of coordination these movements and our own have suffered from. Maoism, Trotskyism, and in this country the two wings of Irish republicanism offered ways forward based around building a disciplined and coordinated movement united around agreed slogans. Or at least they appeared to. At this point in time we know these movements also failed, and although still in existence, were largely irrelevant when this crisis arrived. The history of the organised left, in fact, has been a cycle of such groups discrediting organisation and agreement in the periods of calm between struggles, so that as struggle once more builds and the movement advances, organisation, agreement and discipline are rejected as being identified with that old zombie left by those entering into struggle for the first time. And then, when lacking these very qualities, a new generation fails to achieve change, we see the recreation of such groups in a new form in the process where the movement retreats and regroups. Our challenge is to build the sort of organisation that avoids the pitfalls I have just described, and which can be ready when the tide turns again to intervene with an alternative vision at the scale and development that is needed to tear the understanding of those events out of the hands of the pro-capitalist media and the sell-out leadership of the unions. This has been done in the past, whether we talk of the United Irishmen, the Chartists, the revolutionary syndicalists of the early 1900s who achieved this on an international scale, and even, although highly flawed, the Communist parties of the 1920s and 1930s. More comfortably, we can talk of the Spanish anarchist movements of the 1930s that grew to the point before the revolution in Spain, where as many as 500,000 workers had joined the CNT. Or in the modern period, we can look at the Zapatista movement in Mexico, very localised, but on that local level, achieving what we're talking about here. All of these movements saw revolution not as a distant possibility, but as a moment in the near future, and very often the immediate future. What do they have in common? Ambition. A desire to grow and be influential, and perhaps most importantly, a vision of the future which inspired and encouraged people to get involved. Not some distant vision of a utopia for their grandchildren, but rather one that insisted revolutionary change was possible now. The challenge for us today is to see how we can build such movements without repeating the hard-learned errors of the past. Our goal is not to rebuild the old left because the old left failed. Whether or not there will be a revolution in our lifetimes is not a question of crystal balls, but a question of what we do to prepare for the turning points that will arise. So at this point, there should be about 5 minutes of discussion, but unfortunately, due to device failure, I don't have that. What I did manage to do was record the last 30 or so minutes of the discussion, so that's actually going to start now.
...create more anger, but not having any clear direction. What I think is ways of marriage and activity in the streets. Deliberately is symbolic. We know its limitations, but it's quite radical. Say, for example, you say, pick a date in 4 months' time and say, we're going to shut down the FSC. Now, we may or not succeed in that, but we'll use that period of time in proclaiming it very publicly to make it clear what we're about. And in those kind of instances, I think that's when you start to draw people in particular ways. Now, it's a different form of activity than, for example, working in community development, education, or within the trade unions. But I also think it's a really important element, you know. It's the kind of thing that I'm personally interested in, I guess, as well. So, you know, that's the thing I think most useful at. But I think in terms of, yeah, I guess to kind of hold that together, I think sometimes when we're looking at this kind of overwhelming notion of transforming society that we miss the sort of small steps in radicalization and the process of sort of inner confidence that's collectively shared down through activity. I think that's kind of useful.
Yeah. Can I just say one thing?
Yeah. Sorry, brilliant. Go ahead, yeah.
All right. I completely agree with you, and I think like big discourses around the economy at the moment are completely unuseful because you say capitalism has become common sense. The people, meaning that the people are kind of stupid, that the people are alienated, or something like that. But I think at the moment the problem is completely the opposite. Like the problem today is that everyone knows that capitalism is a shit. Everyone knows that the states are stealing money, that are giving the money to the banks. Everyone knows that. Everyone hates capitalism. But no one does anything. So the problem is not an economic problem. The problem is that there is no transition between the economic analysis. Why, after the crisis, nothing happened? Because there is no transition between the economy and politics. So what kind of step would you have seen, for example, from the economic crisis of 2008 to a political mobilization of people? I mean, there is three-quarters of the world that are in an economic crisis since ages, I mean, and there is no revolution happening. I mean, you mentioned Nepal, there is an interesting movement in India, but I don't see anything happen. It's not harshness, it's not victimhood, it's not bad life or the anger of people that take to revolution. There must be something else, and this something else is a subjective element that just an economic analysis fails to find out. This is
I
think at the moment, as I said, I think at the moment we're ripe for it. Ireland is ripe for some sort of, not revolution, social revolution, but it is ripe for a change. Now the people, when they go out and vote when the next election is, out of desperation will probably vote for the Labour Party. So what I'm saying is, as this man here said, We have to make ourselves visible. We have to be seen. We have to let kids in these housing estates in Limerick and Tala and Clondalkin know that we exist. And that there's things they can do if they want to come out and do something. We have to open up their consciousness, as we'd say, so they understand what's going on, or a little bit better understand what the situation is. And like that man says, if you were to say 3 months' time, we're having a big march, a big meeting, we close down the IFSC, I'm guaranteeing you people will go. It's just a matter of how we do it and how we reach them people.
Just on the point that you made about you don't think it's objective but subjective. I think that although there are large kind of numbers of people in the world who experience kind of grinding poverty every day, and they don't, you know, seem to be geared towards insurrection. I think what generates the kind of objective conditions for social change is the fact that we ascertained quite a bit during the Celtic Tiger. I mean, living standards shot up, and it's the process of having that taken away. You know, people got comfortable, they had a job, they had a nice house, and now they're having all that taken away from them that kind of generates the antagonism required to make them look at social alternatives. But, yeah, that's
what I say, that there are people that are...
I think the majority of people in Ireland and England were very connected, do not want to deal with the political system as is, but they don't know any alternative. I think people are quite radical in the sense that they're deeply discontented, but they don't see, because there is, apart from us, I mean, the left-wing parties I think, are viewed in the same colour as the right-wing parties. I think people correctly see the party system, the so-called democratic system, the electoral system, as being just a complete failure. And they're not prepared to invest their time and their energy in some other new Lenin or some other new hero, because it's all been done before and it's all failed. Okay? So I think, you know, anarchism is a real alternative that is offered. Okay? So, I mean, we need to go to the people with the problem and offer them solidarity. Not offer them solidarity, but create a focus for solidarity, so that each individual sort of, you don't see that they're on their own. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, for example, like, the other day, Christine Buckley came to meet the Socialist Party about the crisis of the church. Now, none of us are religious, but the crisis of the church is extremely important because of the power of the church in Irish society, and that leaves people thinking, you know. Now, Christine Buckley basically did not have the solution to the problem of abuse in Ireland. And, you know, at that meeting, I made the point that the problem is the church is a hierarchy. And the only solution that's been put out is to remove the church hierarchy out of the schools and health and replace it with a new hierarchy called HSE. Which, you know, for me, I can see the exact same type of abuse and the same problem happening again. So I think if we make an argument that the problem is not, you know, the ideology, that it's not that people are bad, like in the church, but simply that we have these sort of corporations, you know, that the state solution doesn't work. And we need to be talking to the people with the problem and unite them in some form of network or some form of solidarity where people can work together, and it has to be done on a local level.
Your
subject
for a second.
That takes
time.
Oh, that's okay. No, it's
okay. Just to go back on a couple of the points that haven't been answered, I just touched on. The left unity question actually is an interesting one and an important one. I certainly think if the left as it existed had got together in a more coherent way right at the start of the crisis, it could have had more of an impact than it did. I don't think it could have transformed things, because I think the left is simply too small at that point. Like, it's kind of, if I was going there, we'll start from here type situation. We were in reality too weak in 2008. We didn't have enough stuff sorted out. Things could have shifted a bit, but I think it was, by that point in time, it's already too late. I think the idea of left unity, though, if you're thinking about it in terms of everybody getting into a single organisation with a single newspaper, is a waste of energy in terms of trying to create. I mean, the left in Ireland and internationally is too old, right? The divisions are too old, too historical for that process to really work and end up with something that would have any particular meaning to it. I mean, in fact, in Ireland, what always happens is as soon as people start talking about it, they start talking about electoral unity, and then they realise that they can't get on because they want to run. You know, they have different ideas about who the best candidate in particular constituency here are. So it's almost farcical. Like, we're lucky in a way because we don't involve ourselves in the electoral process. We've got to get to spectate on the rest of the people that try to do this. And you're kind of looking at them going, oh my God, that's such a nightmare. I can see why it's not going to work out. The issue of the manifesto somebody brought up, that what was needed was, you know, a manifesto for an alternative. That's quite a hard actual question. I think there's a certain level of truth in it. But it's far from straightforward, because part of the problem, I think, is that almost anything you put out is then going to be instantly rubbished by this. I mean, and you can see this where different suggestions have been made, even sort of Sinn Féin's fairly lukewarm alternative budget prospect. You suddenly get the entire media coming down on this, and you get sort of every economist explaining why this is wrong. I think there's also a debate about how far you want to go down that line. You know, the whole debate about, do you want to be managing capitalism, is that the sort of thing you want to be put forward? You know, some people say you don't really need to go beyond saying, well, the workers shouldn't have to pay for the crisis, the rich should have to pay, and there's no particular need for us to detail the ways that should happen. I'm not that sympathetic to that position myself, but it is an argument. I think in terms of the WSM, no, we don't have such a document. Probably in terms of actual involvement in stuff, though, like we've had a fairly heavy involvement in Shelter Sea, and one of the main things it's been pushing in the last year and a half, and that's partly due to the fact we think this is a good idea, is the whole oil and gas giveaway issue. You know, as yes, there is actually another source of funds, that's one source you could go after. You could put time into developing a complex sort of different set of proposals. I'm not sure it would transform the situation. The other stuff I'm going to cover, I mean, in terms of when I was thinking of coming here tonight and doing the talk, what I didn't want to do is come and say all the things that made people in the movement feel all comfy and snug because it's what we all agree with and it's what we always talk about. And sort of, you know, all the traditional critiques of the way the left does stuff. What I actually wanted to do was try and challenge some of those. And like, the ones I definitely want to challenge is the idea that, oh, there's all these small steps out there that are happening, there's all these other processes. That's what's important, not these big questions. I think we've been shown to be completely wrong. We didn't have the answers to the big questions, and all the little stuff got blown away. I mean, if you look what happened to the community sector when the crisis arrived, you have 20 years of organisation of the little questions, 20 years of really quite solid work in a lot of areas, that was blown away in the course of about 6 to 8 months. You know, and it was precisely because the big questions hadn't been seen as important, and it was big, but it was isolated, that it was possible to do that. So I think it's a mistake to comfort ourselves that we don't need to deal with the big questions because the smaller ones will somehow magically come together and deal with them for us. That's not what our experience has been in this period. I also would question the idea that everyone hates capitalism. I don't think that's true. I think most people don't even see capitalism, and I don't think this is because they're stupid. You know, I don't think that's the way to describe it. What they see is society working in the only way they have seen society working. They don't have counterexamples. I mean, you know, historic stuff like Spain or Russia, you feel about it precisely. It's not a great counterexample to tell people about. It's so old. I mean, you know, like this is like Russia was a peasant society in extreme poverty. It doesn't look like a counterexample to most people. They're kind of like, what the hell? That's got no relevance to Dublin today. And the way the debate has been presented in the media, even in terms of quite small alternative proposals, has been, you can't do that, that's not the way things work, that's not going to work, it's not human nature, it's not X, Y, or Z. And most people have internalised those arguments. You know, if you listen to talk radio, which I'm stuck at work listening to it all day, Joe Duffy, you know, all those guys, you get people ringing in. It's just been constantly reproduced again and again. You know, the people's solutions are not collective ones. It's not the system is, you know, the capitalism is the problem. If we get together, we can do something about it. The problem is that the person down the road is getting more social welfare than they're entitled to, or the public sector worker has got a pension that they don't. So it's this whole blend of things that are people seeing other things. I also think and it's an important difference actually, there's a difference between crisis and poverty. You know, yes, you know, of course the world's population have been living in extreme poverty for the best part of 100 years now under the imperial system, and that doesn't mean you're seeing revolutions happening everywhere. But crisis is something different. Crisis is when one thing is happening and then that suddenly breaks and something else starts happening entirely. I mean, crisis in this country is where everybody is thinking, you know, economically life's not so bad, I'm making money, you know, my house is worth a lot more than it was, everything's going up. You know, I've got a job, the kids are going to get a job, you know, there's a whole lot of crappy stuff going on, but it's not too bad. And then suddenly that ends, and suddenly it's for a lot of people, you're right off a cliff, and you've been falling now for, you know, a year or 18 months. And that's different from poverty because it's the sort of point at which people might start to go, what the fuck, what's the story here? You know, everything that I had believed in has kind of been thrown up in the air, where's it going to land? And that's the last thing I wanted to come down to in terms of, you know, challenging our certainties. I really don't think we can change that through clever stunts. You know, I don't think it's a question of a demonstration. I don't think it's a question of doing something at the IFSC or whatever. I mean, you can do that and you can get 1,000 people out. You can get 5,000 people out. You know, but we saw that sort of stuff happening, say, even around the anti-war movement here. It doesn't necessarily transform anything in itself. The big challenge in terms of transforming stuff is having the numbers and the influence where people live and where people work, you know. So it's not, I mean, we can provide an alternate spectacle on the television once a year where we go and trash something, and maybe people watch that at home, and instead of feeling miserable briefly about the fact that, you know, another 10,000 jobs have gone, they're vaguely cheered up because somebody's put in a window in the IFSC. So then maybe they have this moment of feeling cheerful, but it's still a spectacle. It's still something most people are consuming. Until you get to the point where you're actually able to bring those arguments directly to where people are working, to where people are living, and where it's not, you know, it's not the television that's telling this, it's the guy down the street or the guy who sits across the desk from them or whatever. You know, until we get to that sort of point, I don't think we can transform things. Now, stunts, they can be useful perhaps in moving us a little bit towards there, but we need to think in much more ambitious terms. In terms of, if you really, you know, this revolution of the lifetime question, if we wanted to transform this society, then when there's a crisis, when there's an opportunity, what would we need of that opportunity? And what we need are numbers, What we need is agreements about what we want to do. And what we need are kind of the skills and the networks to actually implement those ideas. I think that they're the simple things, because we're fighting against this huge machine that has a lot of resources.
Can we just come back to that point? I think you're kind of over-egging my point about what role of like particular actions or spectacles actually are. But in reality, it was notions of spectacles and the anti-war activity and what happened around 2004, for example, swelled the ranks of WSL as a revolutionary anarchist organisation. So it does have tangible impacts to a large degree. So I don't think it's as easy to dismiss it in the road to revolution. So I think the small steps are kind of important. You know, they're really, really important. To go back to the point about not everybody seeing it as capitalism, I agree. Everybody doesn't articulate their lived experience as I'm suffering under capitalism. But they do articulate like how fucking crap their lives are at the moment in time, you know? And I do think the whole point about crisis, actually being crisis, is useful. I think that's real. Anyway, yeah.
Sorry, that one mentions their hand up for a while.
I guess it's just a point about everyone who's mentioning Joe Duffy or TV kind of brainwashing people. But I guess in terms of like different generations, I think that's only relevant for the older generation. I think for the younger generations, those medias are obsolete, and so it's kind of pointless to have a radio show or printed media. And when I lived in America, they had very, very sophisticated alternative media networks that broadcasted news to people who, consumed liberal kind of had liberal ethics and liberal news, and also they had mass those kind of online networks were able to massively support, as much as I don't like them, but they supported Obama, and they raised like millions and millions of dollars to support him from like regular people. So, and I kind of agree with this gentleman who said that these kind of like, they can't just appeal to like an intellectual elite, they have to appeal to like a much broader population, so they have to have other stuff rather than just news. They have to have like, I don't know, like sexy women or whatever the hell it sells, like, you know, and it has to be online. That's just like my opinion. If you want to appeal to like mass populist kind of people, you have to appeal on every level, and you have to beat the kind of Fox News at its own game.
Sure.
Yeah, I would like to say that I agree with you on when you say that we should be vigilant and see opportunity happen. But we should also train us to see different opportunities. When the opportunities we were thinking were the good one are starting to fail, because now you say that the crisis is different from poverty, but we have seeing that in Ireland anything happened after a crisis, anything happened, just a demonstration, everyone is talking about that demonstration, but this was nothing. And I remember you that the last time we had a huge crisis in Europe, it was followed by fascism. So we have to be really careful to play this game. I have the sensation that many of these issues, like deep crisis, are part of the spectacle and are part of the state organization. If we really want to build a revolutionary movement or a movement for social change, we don't even know what is the revolution, and we don't even know what will we do after the revolution. But if we want to do that, if we want social change, we have to organize independently, and as much like the questions have to be huge. You know, the questions have to be universal, equality. And a better life for everybody. But the situation doesn't allow us to think about organizing a mass movement at the moment. I don't see any mass movement rising nowhere. And Mark is right. We have to start from small point and to hold tight on those points we believe into and create a multiplicity of situation. This is the only solution. There is no unity of the left, and there is no representation of a mass movement that can work at the moment. This is.
Sure.
That kind of small-scale direct action, I think it can potentially alienate the movement amongst people who aren't politically inclined. If they see, you know, I don't know, 5-6 people going chaining themselves to the, you know, again, I think it gets back to what Andrew was saying about almost an avoidance of the larger issues, like the fact that we don't actually have some kind of coherent economic alternative. And it is really, I think, a result of postmodern influence on the left. And I just think that there's a huge disconnect between that kind of direction that the libertarian left seems to be heading in and what ordinary people can do.
I think I was just thinking, like, what you were saying about transforming society, like, if we really want to transform society, we need to engage with society and work with people where they're at and not where we want them to be. And it's really, like, I'm just thinking about it a lot when we're sitting here, that we're speaking a language that really doesn't relate to people where they're at now, and that I feel like a lot of what's being said is really presumptuous, that we understand where what people's lives are like, when I think that we just have a shared understanding that capitalism isn't really working. And I don't know how useful it is for us to just, I think we're doing a lot of imagining right now, and I think, like, it's not that useful to imagine what the ingredients are for baking a revolution when we have no idea, like, we haven't asked the people who we want to be doing it what they actually want from it. And, yeah, I don't know.
Just
some pessimism.
No, it's just a bit of like, I'm not trying to over fetishize small scale direct action. I'm talking about stuff that you can do working along with people that actually attempt to reimagine themselves, you know? So it's not, I don't have any illusions that, like, you know, going back and trying to shut down the FC 20 times a year is going to overthrow capital. That's not the thing. But I think it'd be foolish not to look at the lived experiences of activity that people involved in and help them reimagine themselves and actually bond into people in a revolutionary way.
Yeah, and then we have to play with, I think, another type of desires, because if we always make the economic discourse, you know, and we talk to people based on their own interests, you know, and it's what union do more or less to rise salaries, to work less, or this kind of stuff, you just touch something, you touch a point of the subjectivity of people that is influenced every day by capitalism. You know, capitalism is based on this idea of interest, in this idea of making your own interest. I mean, we should, as she said, really work close to people and try to understand what people think at the moment. And we, I mean, political organization don't really know what people think at the moment, and you see this is really clear, because when a real opportunity arises, for example, we had the 2005 riot in France, that you never see, like, a bunch of young people taking control of entire parts of the city for weeks. This is something that a social movement organized can dream, like, in that moment, and those were depoliticized people, were not organized people, were not organized by Communist Party, anarchist group, by no one. In that moment, those anarchist group in France were not doing anything, were incapable of acting, because they had, or communist group, they didn't have any relation to people. They couldn't give any answer to those young people doing those acts. So the first thing is to go to people, is to discover what people think, and to radicalize together, to try to change ourselves first together with the people. This is
Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I picked the example of the economy as an example of something, you know, a point at which there's change and people are being woken up is because of where we're living now and what's been happening over the last couple of years. But it, because the elephant in the room is obviously the economic crisis, that has been the big point of holy shit. I could have, and in fact I probably would have if I was going to write something longer, have talked about other examples of the same sort of thing, because it's not, there are often several things that cause these sort of crises. Like another one that we often, in terms of WSM stuff, we often use as an example was the X case in the 1990s, which radically transformed the way people saw church power and the relationship between the church and the state in this country. Like, absolutely massive transformation that transformed a lot of social life in the 1990s and the way people related to each other. You could also use the anti-war movement to an extent. I think somebody referred to that, although I think that also shows some of the limitations of that. And certainly, yeah, the Vandalou riots in France. I mean, in a way, that is an interesting example as well, because it's an example of one of the problems of... It's the negative side of what I'm actually talking about, which is that the problem with kind of groups that exist and have collective agreements and structure and all the rest is they're often not very good at relating to new things as they emerge. They don't know what to do, right? So when I'm making the arguments for them, for that sort of structure, I'm not making that argument in the context that there is no negative side to it. I'm making the argument in the context that most of the people we're talking to in these meetings only see the negative side and don't see the positive side, and because of that, I think we've lost out to an extent. I agree that a lot of people at the moment think their lives are crap, right? I don't think that's anti-capitalism, because the big problem with a lot of people at the moment thinking their lives are crap is what they're hoping for is simply a return to the Celtic Tiger. That's what they see the way out of it. They don't see a transformation of the economic system as being a way out of it. And because that's what they see, it actually means that the government rhetoric that, you know, if everyone tightens their belt, we'll have a rough couple of years, but then we'll go back to where we are, has an attraction for people. You know, people are actually sort of going, well, maybe that's true. You know, maybe if I, you know, just put my head down for a few years and get by, I'll go back to that situation. And it's that, to me, is the big... The issue of why we weren't able to make a difference at the start of this process. You know, that there just simply weren't enough of us, that we didn't have the arguments developed, we didn't have the sort of collective agreement that we'd be able to say, no, this is why this is happening. Not like on the internet, but I agree, by the way, social networking stuff, all that's cool, and we actually, probably one of the better things we do, and one of the things we're actually quite good at. But, you know, I think it has the same problem that television and radio does, it's something people consume. You know, when they like something or whatever, but doesn't necessarily mean they're going to act on it. And I think that's the problem. It's that mass involvement of people in the process that's important. It's also the problem with the spectacle stuff. I mean, you know, WSM can recruit people out of the anti-war movement, it can recruit people out of any sort of demonstration, but if it's still 40 of us, or 60 of us, or 80 of us, or 120 of us, it's still going nowhere. It's the problem is how you break out of from those sort of numbers to the sort of numbers that are involving thousands of people. I think that's the big challenge for us. Otherwise, we keep doing the circle.
So guys, I hope to be clear because my English is not very good. We try. I mean, I don't think that nobody know the way how can generate some movement. Okay, the movement at some point happen. Okay, and you need just to follow it. In this context, so I don't know very well the situation in Ireland, from a different country. The problem is, so I agree with the interview methods, okay, when you go to the people, ask the people what is your problem, what are your problems, people, and you can try to build something about this stuff. But if you look, we are almost 25, so out of this side, you know that there is a lot of people that doesn't give a shit about capitalism and crisis and stuff like this. And this is the big problem, okay, for me. And I suppose that we need to... My idea, so I grew up in a movement, student movement in Italy, in social center, and autonomy, stuff like this, that you need to fight the capitalism every day, in every place. Okay, and this means that on the work, at the university, at pub, in the social center, on the street, on the bus, in every place. And it's quite difficult to the people when you have a good idea to explain at workers at work or for I work for 3 euro and 20 each hour. When I come back at home, I don't give a shit about the economy, capitalism. That's fine. A lot of people think in this way, in my opinion. And this is our problem, because we need to know how can how can drive this mass of people. Because this is the big problem. Because we are 20, and in 20 or 25 we do very, very few things.
I just say the last thing, that in the case of Paris, I want to come back to that because it was striking, but we could discuss about other issues. Like the problem and this representative, the problem is not, I think, that the left, and this is a huge problem, it's not that the left couldn't take that occasion for good. The problem is that the left is not representing at all that working class it pretends to represent. And probably this is because there is no working class anymore. I mean, what happened in Paris was really clear. Like, what we usually call working class was rebelling, and those organizations that traditionally are supposed to represent it were totally detached from it, and many of them were also criminalizing those young people, were saying there was just scum, that there is nothing political in it, and condemning them as the power would do. So we have to recognize that there are some old political concepts, some concepts that are completely exhausted at the moment. And I would say the concept of class, you can't create, and this is demonstrated during the last at least 30 years, like any movement starting from the concept of class or that represent any notion of class. And then second, the concept of party. Like, if we have to organize, we organize completely differently from a party model. So we should, like, really live that way, because we have seen what was happening to parties, and I don't say just capitalist parties, but also communist parties around the world. So I think, first of all, independency and contact with the people without any substantialization of the people that doesn't exist.
And the last word.
Yeah, the last word to say, in regards of a manifesto or some sort of a declaration, like, all we need to be is a set of truthisms. Like, why does one banker need a 1.5 million pension when everybody's house is in negative equity? They're living on £200 a week. Like, once it's a declaration, yeah, it'll probably get put down by everybody, but you know, that is life. Anybody that puts that out there has to accept that it's going to be given a green shoot. In regards to people and how many people are in the organisation, I mean, the Bolsheviks weren't that fucking big when they took off the revolution, you know what I mean? It's just a group of people. It's how they influence the rest of the people or influence their ideas. And that's basically about it.
Sorry, just
I want to give the example of the community workers people. You know, when their funds are cut off. I saw it in the media post where they were having a protest, and in that protest they said, "We're standing here outside the People's Parliament." Now, I don't think any people on the left were ever really dealing with these community workers, right? And I would have loved to have been in contact with them. Is that not the problem? And for the last 20 years, you were suckered into this phony partnership, okay? You sold your own people down the river, because these are really, really sound organisers in their communities. Let's make no mistake about that, okay? But they were suckered, they were bribed, basically, right? Into taking the shilling off the state, right? And then when you know, the state had a little bit less money to give out, they gave it to their cronies and said, basically, fuck you. We should be there with them, saying, that's... You know, you created this crisis by taking that bribe in the first place. And by the way, you know, there is no People's Parliament. This isn't the fucking People's Parliament. You know what I'm saying? Now, I think something needs to be set up in every district, or, you know, I know there's only small numbers there, but not a political party, but just simply a kind of network of people, not necessarily left leaning, but the Irish left is so small, hardly matters. You know, basically a network of people come together who are involved in the struggles, where they can offer solidarity to each other on a local basis and on a national basis. Like, trade unionists need to work together on a national basis, because we have a trade union leadership that has taken the... You know, that's one of the reasons why there's no reaction to this crisis, is because all the means of organisation have been, you know, they've collaborated, well, the leadership has. But that's what we need, is to make contact with people who have the problems. Not as people are saying, not offer them solutions, but to contact people who have the problems.
Okay, well, maybe we can continue this on outside, because there's a meal cooked outside for the Breaking the Shomer to be an Indian. The next in the series is on this day, 2 weeks, on the 5th of May, and in that meeting, Eileen O'Carroll is going to look at the sequence of contradictions of working in a global industry. The myth is that workers work happily 6 hours a week, but like workplace of a previous era, there is struggle over the nature of work, the length of time that people work within their lives. So that tends to focus on a form of visible struggles conducted through trade unions. What can this other level of often individualised struggle teach us in the fight for a new world? So I think that's probably touching some of the stuff we're talking about. And finally, obviously, May Day is coming up. It's on, obviously, the 1st of May, 2 o'clock at the Garden of Remembrance's demonstration. The great people went, work so there, people will be there. So thanks again for coming, and probably continue this outside.
This audio is a recording from the Rethinking Revolution discussion series held in Shomer-Spree. This recording was made in April 2010 at the second of these sessions, and it's on revolution in our lifetime. This audio was recorded and edited by Andrew Flood. You'll find my writings at anarchism.pageabode.com. You'll find more audios like this on the WSM website at www.wsm.ie.